Depolitization was presented by David Crabtree at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute, entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
And it's unfortunate that I didn't catch this until we were actually in the discussion, but the chapters that I wanted people to read are the one on depolitization, and then the last chapter, I can't remember what it's called, the Men and Democracy. So, because those are the two concluding chapters. So let me tell you what he says in those two chapters. And then I was going to talk about some implications of that, but if I'm reading body language correctly, I think there are a few questions. So let me just summarize what he says in these last two chapters, and then I'll throw it open for questions, and we'll see where it goes from there. Alul's response to this political illusion, he's saying, well, how do we address this? And he's saying, basically, you might think that I would advocate us becoming apolitical. And his response to that is, nothing could be further from the truth. He doesn't want people to become apolitical, but he wants people to become depoliticized. And what he means by that is you need to get away from thinking about politics the way that our culture has encouraged us to think about politics. He says that it would be futile to try to change society through the existing political order. What we need is a change in perspective that leads to a broader change. He points out that democracy always has needed to be fought for and continues to be the kind of thing that you have to fight for. It doesn't happen naturally. It's a struggle to achieve and maintain democracy. And we need to do that, but we need to act effectively as we do so. And therefore, it's important to understand the true nature of the problem, and that's what he's been trying to lay out in the book. And as I mentioned this yesterday, but if you have to understand the nature of the problem, otherwise the solution will not work. If the problem is a virus, an M16 won't get it. And you may do more damage than you do good. So what do we need? What does depoliticizing involve? The first thing he says is we need to rid ourselves of the myths. And in particular, he's talking about the myths with respect to politics. What in fact is politics? How in fact does it work? To what extent have we just been fed a bunch of myths that don't match with reality? And he points out that one needs to be really careful about vocabulary. Just because we've retained the word democracy doesn't mean that we've retained the content democracy. Just because we've retained the word liberty doesn't mean that we've retained liberty, etc. He points out that we do not have a genuine voice, and we actually need to achieve that. He doesn't go in this, but I was reflecting on it. There are many on the left of the political spectrum today who would say, we don't have a political voice. They would absolutely agree with Alul. But what they would argue is, we need to organize grassroots, and we need to fight big business and those kinds of interests. And I was thinking, Alul would not agree with that. That is just acting politically to try to address the problem of our democracy not being democratic. And I think Alul's perspective is you can't solve it through the system. It has to be done differently. Another thing that he reminds us of is that politics cannot solve any significant problem. It's just the most significant problems in human existence are not solvable through political means, period. And we need to disabuse ourselves of that notion. Okay, so what can we do? And then in part of chapter 7, he talks about what we can do. And there he's talking about what can we do primarily as a group, as a society. What can we do to address this on a more societal level? And the first thing he says is society needs to carry out education and information, the dissemination of information, differently. And we could talk at great length about the issue with respect to education. It's Alul argues this elsewhere, and I think he's absolutely right, that education has lost its way in our culture, and that one of the most critical things that education has to achieve is to help students become independent, capable thinkers. And our system doesn't value that whatsoever. And I know they would say that they do, and we can talk about this at great length, but I'm convinced that they do quite the opposite of that, and that is part of what has gotten us into this problem. I would agree with Alul completely. So education needs to be completely redone, and we need to take on the project of helping to educate one another to be independent and capable thinkers. And information, the dissemination of information, has been all messed up, and I would agree with him completely there as well. That it was mentioned that during the break that de Tocqueville gives two safeguards against the creation of this monumental entity, the government, and majority rule. The two safeguards that the individual has are the press and the courts. The press, and I think it's absolutely right. Alul would say both of those have been gutted as far as a safeguard against the abuses of the government. The press doesn't really care about keeping us informed, helping us to understand what's going on out there and the way that it's happening. It has turned into a completely different thing. And so the difficulty that we have in our time is getting good information, and that's a real chore. And I mentioned it to somebody, but my son is in Israel, and there was a firefight that broke out there, and so I've been trying to figure out what happened there. And I get on the internet to find news articles, and every news article depicts it differently. And as time goes on, now I'm seeing evidence buried in news articles that make the first news articles absolutely impossibly wrong. The way they described it, it couldn't possibly have happened that way. And it's just fascinating to me how many different versions you get of an event, and how hard it is to sort out what happened. And that's always going to be the case. I mean, if you've ever been in a criminal trial, and you hear different eyewitness testimony, there's always conflicting evidence and conflicting testimony that has to be sorted out. But my concern is the press isn't really helping us in that respect. Doesn't help us to sort it out. It doesn't really care to help us sort it out. So education and information need to be done differently. The second thing he talks about at some length is the value of tension in human existence. That as a culture, we've decided that tension and conflict and struggle is a problem, and you get rid of it at all costs. You sweep it under the rug or whatever, but you need to get rid of it as soon and as possible and as easily as possible. Allure was pointing out that struggle is so much a part of human existence. If you take that struggle out, you are taking life out of human existence. It is so important to helping us to grow up to become mature human beings that it is a travesty to take it out. And in fact, it needs to be embraced in the sense that every situation where there's tension or conflict is an opportunity for us to become better at resolving those and to facing into the issues that arise in the midst of that. And as a result, becoming more whole human beings. The third thing as a society that he encourages us to do is to begin to develop a community or communities that are not deluded by the myths, that can see things more clearly as they are, and to band together and to become so large that it can become a counterbalance to the state. And I think Allure is really looking back at de Tocqueville, and de Tocqueville is looking at that situation where you've got the king, and you've got the nobility, and then you've got the people, and the nobility are a power that the king has to reckon with. They are of such a magnitude that the king has to reckon with them, and therefore it's a counterbalance to the king. And I think Allure is advocating we need to somehow create that kind of counterbalance to the government. He goes on to say, I'm not saying that it's possible. He's just saying that we need to try. I would say it's not possible. Yeah. Okay, then personally, and this is what he talks about in the last chapter, that more fundamentally what has to happen is that we as human beings need to be restored as human beings, that we need to work hard at becoming whole human beings, recognize what the culture around us is doing to us, and work towards becoming more whole human beings. That rationality is important. Reasoning things is important, and reason works. And we need to develop our reason and apply it. That we need to respect one another. We need to learn how to value minority views. Not just see them as enemies, but see them as valuable in and of themselves, that there might be, we should look at more minority views as something that we can learn from, even if we disagree with them fundamentally. We need to learn to engage in genuine dialogue, where there is respectful exchange of opinions, and a respectful attempt to even convince one another. And on the other hand, we need to fully understand the cultural situation that we find ourselves in, the nature of technique, what kind of an impact it has on the way that we see the world and think about the world, and to resist its pull. I said before that in his academic works, he doesn't get into theology, and his theological works are more specifically theological. But his theology really does come into his academic works, and I think this last chapter, chapter 8, is actually a call to conversion, a call for reformation, starting with the individual, because that's essentially what needs to happen, and I think that that's exactly what he recognizes. There's a spiritual problem, ultimately, that we're dealing with, and that spiritual problem has to be addressed by each individual in their own hearts. Okay, let me open it up for questions, and then we'll see. That may take the rest of our time. Margaret?
Might say, I think maybe I hear a contradiction here. Because on the one hand, we're talking about people, socialists, who the socialists as opposed to the true individualists. Socialists want to apply reason to everything to come up with the truth and the ideal situation. But just now, and we said, no, that's not going to work. And then just now, you talked about elevating reason.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to actually start thinking rationally and actually value reason. So that could sound like a contradiction. So what are you talking about, the use of reason, that makes it different from what socialists are doing? The socialists are doing wrong, but there's a right way of doing it, or what's wrong with what the socialists are doing as opposed to what you're advocating?
Mm-hmm. I think let me give the kind of reason that I'm advocating a term. Let's call it humble reason. That what went wrong in the Enlightenment was this assumption that human reason could figure out the world and we could harness it to our purposes. And there was an enormous amount of arrogance in that whole process, that they overestimated the ability of human reason to be able to resolve all of it, understand all of its problems, and resolve them. The reality is, we can't. Human reason is extremely limited, and we have a very difficult problem, a very difficult time deciding what is the true nature of the problems that we face. And it's keeping track of what we know that we know, and what we know that we don't know, that's critical to the whole project. And there is also the issue that I talked about yesterday, and that is our problem is not just ignorance, but it's foolishness. And so part of the problem is people relying on their reason in their rebelliousness against God, that there's a distorting effect on the reason itself. And so we need a humble kind of reason that keeps track of what we know and how we know it, and also keeps track of the fact that we are creatures created by God, and He knows reality a little better than we do.
So, humility, and one of my issues when I hear people talk about reason is I recognize that sometimes people are talking about what I would think of as logic, which human beings are actually pretty good at doing, and versus information, and not recognizing that you operate upon information with logic to come up with what we call knowledge, but our information can be limited, and also the information we can be using is actually could be assumptions, values, that we don't even realize that we're using. So given that distinction, if I were to say we're actually pretty good at reason, if what you mean by that is constructing logically valid syllogisms, given these assumptions, we can operate on them and say therefore thus and such. But where the problem comes in is the presuppositions we're starting with, or the bits of information that we're starting with, that we're operating with our logic. If you start out, garbage in, garbage out, if you start out with something that's incomplete information or wrong information or values that you're not taking into account, where do those values come from? It's going to be the garbage in, garbage out kind of thing. And so that's where the humility really needs to come from. Our minds are very well-constructed computers, but if you give a computer garbage, it will produce garbage. And having the humility of knowing that our information is limited, that there's just a lot we don't know, we can't operate on facts that we don't have. Mm-hmm. And if you don't take the fact that you have values into account, then you're kind of, sometimes we can do it in an unsophisticated way and not recognize that we're making fallacious mm-hmm. conclusions. Does that sound reasonable?
We also have corrupted information.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people's minds are more logical than others. You have a particularly logical mind. Mine is probably less logical than yours, but some people have more logical minds than others. But if you think about it, there isn't much that we know that is arrived at strictly on the basis of syllogisms, by formal logic. That's not how we get there. That you look at the evidence and you evaluate the evidence and you make a judgment. There's a huge amount of judgment that's involved in assessing the evidence that we have to work with, and that's even when it's good evidence, that's what we're dealing with, is assessing it. How does this best fit together? So there's an enormous amount of judgment that's involved in there. And to the extent that we are rebels, our judgment kind of goes in directions that we prefer. And I think that's where our reasoning goes wrong, is we make bad judgment calls as we're assessing the evidence, and that it's hard to make good judgment calls when we're assessing the evidence. But to the extent that we're rebels, that taints the whole process. So I think that's the major source of the problem.
Related to that, your assessment that you believe that what he calls us to in chapter 7 is impossible. My question is, well, on what level is it impossible? And what I mean by that is there's an impossibility for me to see University Avenue in front of the college.
Yeah.
From where I sit. Well, that doesn't. If I change where I sit, then that's no longer impossible. On the other hand, the old acts of, can God make a rock so great that he can't lift it, is impossible from the sense that it's logically contradicting. Therefore, it is impossible in a very different sense. Do you believe that this is an impossibility because God isn't in this business, that he has constructed the world in such a way that it will not happen? Or do you think it's impossible simply because we lack the resources at the moment and a plan and a methodology, a political way. No, do we just lack the resources to be able to pull it off?
I just don't think it's going to happen. I don't think that's where history is going. But really, it's irrelevant what I think, because I would agree with Alul that we need to try. And whether it's impossible or not is irrelevant. It is good for us to try. And especially beginning at the personal level is critical. And then it's just helping those that are around us to begin to take life a little more seriously, to look at it a little more soberly, try to figure out what's going on, and then to respond appropriately in our relationships with other people, etc. That is a project that is extremely valuable. Everybody should be taking that on. Whether it's going to transform the United States or not, I doubt it, but it doesn't really matter. It's still a thing that's worth doing.
Okay. Well, and I would argue that I appreciate where you're coming from, that we need to do this on an individual level. It's going to sound weird, but I'm going to say it anyway. I have a problem in that I think that I've already arrived. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to say that I have really arrived. It's that my perception is that I've already.
Sure.
I think I'm pretty objective. I think I'm basing my actions on objective or on real reality, a better perception than everybody else has because it's my perception, and I might have a little bit of bias there, but. And so there's a sense in which we need to pursue this on a social level because we need each other to inform each other as to where we're not operating this way.
Right. Absolutely.
And
I mean, that's the way that you really come to realize that you haven't arrived is in those interactions with other people. There are going to be problems that arise that are going to face you into things that you haven't faced into before. And that is a good and healthy thing for everybody.
It disturbs me that we're basing this line of reasoning off of a book that's so poorly available. I mean, and I say that from a sense that, you know, it makes me ask, is there a censorship of sorts that's going, that is one of the problems that we need to get around.
There is, in that there are many people for whom this would seem ridiculous. I would be uninterested in even.
But there's a lot of books out there that seem ridiculous to me that are in popular circulation and
right. Right.
So. And I think as a community, we need to go and disseminate just the information of this book to begin with,
right.
Which is, I recognize that you're doing that right now. I guess the question in my mind is how do we go from here? Just getting the information of this, of this material
right.
more broadly available.
I wouldn't say this is the fifth gospel,
okay.
but it is food for thought for everybody. So it's a matter of and there are other books that he has written, I think, that are in some ways more helpful. But it's a matter of thinking about it, sorting it out, what is true here, what is not true here, and interacting with other people about this stuff. And sharpening your thinking and helping other people to clarify their thinking, that's the process that we need to be engaged in.
So let me ask you a little bit more on this just so I cannot be annoyed with you.
Okay.
And because
I hope this deals with addresses my problem.
Let me see if I can pose it this way and see if you would agree or not. When you make the observation that forming communities, getting educated, discussing, working things through, all those sorts of things, probably, or it's not possible that that would provide a counterbalance to the state. I would agree that if that is our plan, and if we decide that we can and will provide a counterbalance to the state by doing that, that's probably futile. I would agree with that. But it seems to me as though if before God we are called to behave in a responsible manner, to make good choices, to do the right thing that is the next thing in front of us to do, that something along these lines, better education and encouraging others to be better educated, forming those small small communities of people, having those discussions. It seems as though if God should choose to use those things to provide a counterbalance, it seems that that's a pretty good path to go down. That's a pretty good way for me to spend my time and to expend some of my energies to do that, should God choose. Not that I can count on mechanically, I do this and this will be the result, but these are good and responsible and worthwhile things to do. And if, by God's grace, he chooses to use those things to provide the counterbalance, great.
Right.
Is that...
Well, I would agree with that completely.
Okay.
I would agree with that completely.
But?
I do think it's important to keep in mind that politics ultimately is not that big a deal.
Is not what?
Is not that big a deal.
Okay.
And to keep it in perspective, in proper perspective, it is something, but it's not that big a deal. And so even to throw oneself into politics, I don't think is wrong. As long as you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. For 20, 25 years, I've had discussions about which is redemptive. Is it the political structures, or is it changing the heart? And I would fall 1,000% on the changing the heart end of things.
Mm-hmm.
But if there are ways to spend our time that might be helpful or effective in helping to make a better society, that's not a bad way to spend some of our time.
That is not a bad thing, right?
Okay.
Absolutely. Right, right. Other questions?
Okay. I know you said you were going to tell us about the implications and then you changed your mind.
Yeah.
I want to hear your implications.
Okay. Okay. Were there any other questions?
Cheer
you up. Yeah. Well, okay. Remind me. I would like to cheer you up at some point. Well, the one that I thought the most about is education. So let's talk just a little bit about education. Implications of what he says in these chapters. I think education does need to be reformed. That's one of the things that he is advocating here, and I think that's absolutely critical. And I have a 7-step technique for doing so. Yeah, measure all outcomes. You know, every educator nowadays is going to say that the goal of education is to produce competent critical thinkers. I mean, that you hear that absolutely everywhere in classes on critical thinking. But the reality is they don't do that. We had a site visit. One of the things that needs to happen in order for there to be the development of genuine critical thinking is there has to be freedom of thought. There has to be the room to explore ideas and to do so without negative repercussions. at one of the site visits, they were critical of us because our faculty all signs the same statement of faith. And they were saying, you can't have freedom of thought in an institution unless you have pluralism. And I was reflecting back on my experience at the university, which was the University of Washington, which was a very pluralistic university. And I was thinking, did that foster freedom of thought? And the answer is no, it did not. Did I feel like I had freedom of thought? No. Was that really encouraged? No, it wasn't. Because there was pluralism, but everybody knew that there were bounds beyond which you could not go. Certain differences of opinion, fine, no problem. But beyond certain lines, there was so much not only social pressure, but there could be ramifications for your grade in classes if you didn't stay within certain kinds of boundaries. And so what you absorb is that it's not truth that's so important, it's a certain kind of conformity to a certain range that's okay. I really think that in our education system, I won't go to it. Here are the things that I think need to be really embraced in order for a good education system to work. One is to stress the value that thinking is indeed important. Fighting against skepticism. Skepticism is prevalent in this generation, and it is difficult to fight against it, but I think we do need to fight against it. It's a skepticism with respect to whether we can know anything. And it is deeply ingrained. It is really deeply ingrained in this generation. They think that any piece of information that they receive is marketing. It is just manipulative. And they kind of throw their hands up and say, given all that, given the fact that all that happens is I'm being marketed, how could I know? And there's an enormous skepticism. Well, we can ask the students, but my sense is that they would go for the former rather than the latter. That they feel like everything has spin on it. And because everything has spin on it, none of it is really reliable, and you can't choose between them. And why bother?
Well, to the extent that you choose, it's just a personal choice, like
no. Sure. No. They have opinions. Right. Some would. The second is that there is work to be done. The truth has not all been figured out. There are still areas that genuinely need to be sorted out. And that their efforts in that regard are worthwhile and beneficial to all of us. The third is that no themes are out of bounds. There are no sacred cows. The fourth is that everyone has something to contribute, and therefore having respect for the opinions of others. And this is one that I found very interesting in Gutenberg, because we have a wide variety of students with a wide variety of different abilities. And it is interesting to see that how students who are academically less capable always have something to contribute. And sometimes it's just the way they act. sometimes just the way they treat other students that can be their contribution, but everybody's got something to contribute, and that's genuinely true. That's not just a platitude. Granting everybody room for deviation, being genuinely tolerant, is also a critical part of an educational system. And that means as teachers, you need to grant room for students to disagree. And as we all know, it is possible for a teacher to subtly belittle someone who disagrees with them, or not subtly. I mean, they can be downright nasty. And we need to really watch out for that. That's disastrous. It's students who are beginning to think are, it's kind of like, well, I guess it isn't true anymore, but it's kind of like it used to be to coax a deer out of the woods or something. And now their deer have become rather bold, but they used to be afraid of people. But it's kind of coaxing, and if you make a wrong move, they're off, they're gone, you've lost your chance. And getting a student to start to think for themselves is that kind of process. You're kind of trying to coax them out, but one wrong move, and that scares them, and they're gone. You have to create an environment in which you can coax them out, that it's safe for them to start thinking through serious questions and taking those serious questions seriously and working them through.
It's not the culture.
Right. And even, I see nothing wrong with the teacher trying to persuade the student of the teacher's perspective, but it all needs to be done in an atmosphere of respect for the student. That it's not, there's nothing about it that is demeaning or threatening, or it is a genuine and respectful attempt to persuade. There's nothing wrong with that. And then my last quality that education has to have is the humility of the teacher, and this is getting to what Peter was talking about. That it is genuinely true that I, as a teacher, I don't know everything, not even close to it. And even what I think I know, some of that's probably wrong. And so I am as much of a student as my student is. And keeping that firmly a part of my perspective is critical in this whole process. And keeping in mind that truth is the goal. It is so easy as a teacher to want to have the goal to impress your students. And it's easy to get sidetracked and go down roads that one ought not go. It's hard to keep in mind that truth is actually the goal. That I want to come to the truth, and I want to help enable my students to come to the truth as well. Okay, and then I'm going to skip. I was going to talk about tensions. I'm going to skip that because we've kind of really talked about those, but that is that understanding that struggle is a part of life and that those struggles are important. We need them. They bring us a lot of good. That is so important in our personal lives, and it's exactly what Alul was talking about. Well, in a sense, yes, I'd agree with you that it is important for them to be able to explain the bases for their beliefs, for what they believe to be true. But I don't, in the way that you described it, it's kind of a different thing than we're doing. So it might be helpful for me to describe this, that certainly at Gutenberg, it's not like we are equipping them with the gospel truth and then they go out and defend that in other situations. That what we're trying to do is help students to become competent good critical thinkers. And while they're here, they learn some of that and they make some progress in understanding things, but they've got lots more to learn. So as they go out, my vision would be for them to conduct themselves the same way as they go out, when they go out of here, as they've conducted themselves here, and that is engage in dialogue. It's not, I'm here with the answers and here are my reasons why I think this is true, but go out and engage with people. Why do you think what you think? Let's talk about this. Because the students should see that they may be able to learn something from the other person too. So it's a genuine dialogue, it's a genuine exchange. This is what I think and this is why I think it. What do you think and why do you think it? And to enter into that kind of dialogue wherever they go. And in so doing, carry out a mini education of those people that they interact with. Yeah, well, you just know that I will always speculate. Obviously, I don't know, but I will be disappointed if we get to heaven and there are no problems. I get tired of playing harps. So I really... I really think that there will be issues that need to be resolved, even in heaven. I would hope that that's the case. I would hope that there will be frustrations, there will be challenges, there will be learning that has to happen. But I don't know. And I think that there will be much that will go away, and that'll be fantastic. I mean, that's what we yearn for, is to be freed from that rebelliousness that's just so much a part of who we are as a human being. And that'll be a fantastic burden that is lifted. But I'm hoping that there will still be challenges, there will still be meaningful things to do and things to learn. Mm-hmm. Okay, the only other implication I was going to talk about is basically what he's calling for, what needs to happen is a reformation. And I think if in another context, if you were to talk to him, that's what he would say has to happen. That really apart from an act of God working in the hearts of people on a large scale in our culture, this isn't going to turn around. Or if it does turn around, it won't turn 180, it'll turn 30 degrees. We'll still head basically in the same direction. And even if it were to head in the right direction, it would quickly be perverted and turn back in another direction just because we're still the same kinds of people. So I really think that an implication of this is what he's calling for is reformation. I don't think we can go wrong by devoting our energies to getting right with God and encouraging those around us to see things more clearly and to take life more seriously. I don't think we can go wrong there. Even if it leads to partial success, I don't think we can go wrong. The ultimate consequences of that, who knows what will happen? Could you start a political movement that got commandeered and taken in another direction? Absolutely, that could happen. But I don't think we can go wrong by doing being responsible with what God has placed on our plate and doing the best that we can with that. I think we're on safe ground. Yeah. I really don't know. I think if going beyond and that, what I'm advocating is basically what Peter was saying, is that you be kind of an evangelist for careful consideration of truth, what's out there, of careful consideration of reality, and trying to figure out what is true. But becoming more political than that, I don't really know. I don't have a strategy. I don't really know what we should be doing. Right. Yeah. And I frankly don't think that the education system can be reformed by political means. So I think there are wiser ways to pursue things in the political realm than other ways. And there are a lot of things that should not be political issues and should not be pursued along political lines. But I don't know. I don't know how to reform the political system. I don't know how best to engage it. Okay. Thanks. We'll quit there.